aging may not be for sissies, as legendary actress Bette Davis long ago warned, but aging is especially difficult without money. A recent study shows older women in Hawaii are particularly vulnerable to economic challenges compared to older men. The research comes from Professor Collette Brown at the Myron B. Thompson College of Social Work. So we were wondering, what might younger women take away from the study now to increase their chances of not winding up in senior poverty? Dr. Collette Brown joins us now. Thank you for being here.
Aloha. Thank you.
Just to remind people of some of the top line findings that came out of your study, you're talking about women who are living in poverty at the rate of about 9.1% compared to men at 5.8%. But when you talk about single older women, and we know that women usually outlive men anyway, those findings became even more dramatic.
That's right. And when we talk about single women, we're talking about those who were never married, those who are divorced, those who are widowed. And we found that the poverty rate is extremely high, nearly three times higher than for women who are married. And about 60% of women in Hawaii over the age of 65 are, by that definition, single women.
And are these women the ones that we traditionally look at as being utterly dependent on Social Security, or do they have anything else coming to them on a monthly basis?
Well, we're Social Security is a very big piece of income as we get older for men and for women. But we also look at things like access to pensions, access to assets. The thing about pensions is very few women actually have access to pensions. Also for men, only about 50%, but women have much less. And pensions are a very important piece of that ingredient for a good economic status in later life.
Regardless if someone has a pension or not, it's obviously very dependent upon what's happened over a lifetime of work and saving. And for women, that looks very, very different than it does for men in many cases. Not all, but in many cases where women will outplace to be able to take a part-time job so they can also be involved with having a family. Or they may be needed by their own family at a certain point in time to take care of elders. Why is it such that it's usually the woman, the daughter, who goes off to do this?
I'll bet that's a great question. You know, there is a disproportionate share of caregiving that women do, whether it's for children, whether it's for elderly parents, it's for others in the family. So why women do that really is history, it's values. It's also policies that really don't support women in the workforce. So it's not only our choice per se, but if you look at a family, a traditional kind of family, in a way it makes sense for the woman to stay home and take care of children if, in fact, her salary is half or a third of what her spouse's is. So there's some rationale for that. But policies really aren't jumping in and doing what needs to be done to make things more fair. And the issue here, again, is that pervasiveness of women's lower income throughout their life that ends up and culminates in their poverty in later life.
I mean, none of these things are existing in vacuums. We've known for decades that we may have law that says that there's supposed to be parity for women and men in the workplace, but rarely do we actually see that. Some professions, yes, but certainly not across the board. And we're told usually on average there's about 75 cents that a woman will make to a man's dollar, and that hasn't changed in 50-plus years. For young women now who are hearing all of this and maybe have come through a recession trying to get a job or maybe finding that they are underemployed because they can't find a full-time position, and who may be in the same position as, say, their grandmothers, just trying to make ends meet, if they can, where's the money to do any of this investing that sometimes they're told they should be doing?
Well, that's exactly correct. You can only save when you've already paid for your housing, for your food, for your basic survival. And that's why what you make is so important. I think we have to look at it from an individual and a society perspective. So should we all know more about financial literacy? Of course. All of us should know more about that. You know, I'm embarrassed at how late I was in life learning what compound interest even was. So yes, of course. But that's not the only issue. Where is society's role in terms of assuring that there is pay equity? So we have to look at things, even like increasing the minimum wage. We have to look at making sure that there's pension coverage for women who work part-time, since so many women do work in part-time jobs because they have caregiving responsibilities. What about the issue of parental leave? This is a critical issue, and I'm so pleased that more and more people are talking about it. We're one of the few countries in the Western world that don't even address this today, and this has been going on for so long. So when we talk a lot about, I even hate the word choice, because we talk about a woman making the choice of staying home.
As if sometimes they have one.
That's right, and very often it's not. And I think the other issue is for women who are really working, who have the choice again, that word, of a minimum wage job or taking care of their children. If we don't have adequate child care that's supportive, what kind of choice does that really give a lower income woman in terms of, do I take a job, but my whole salary goes for child care and someone else is raising my children? It really doesn't make sense. I think the other issue that's really come up recently, and I'm really trying to learn more about this myself, is the impact of student debt on retirement planning. There are a number of growing studies now that are really showing the negative correlation between student debt and retirement planning. The student debt now is nearly $1.4 trillion, and the default rate is almost 40% when you consider those who are even late for payments. So what we're seeing is a younger generation of women and men struggling to pay for their college debt. And of course, this is impacting what they can do for their retirement planning.
And you're talking about in years, say from, 23, 25 to 40 and up, where people are carrying this debt for a very long time, which should be in the years in which it might be, quote unquote, easier for them to save. And some of the same questions exist. Do I put money here? Do I put money there? How do I cover all bases? And for many, those bases don't get covered.
That's right. So, again, this is really, when we look at women's poverty in later life and how do we prevent it, looking at younger women, it's complex and it's multifaceted. I don't want to let business off the hook, though, either in this conversation. So we talk about wanting women in the workforce. Well, what is really happening to do that? I was reading a talk that Michelle Obama gave recently to leaders in the tech industry, and she really asked each one of them and said, you say you want women in the workforce, well, then make room. Make room for women. What are you doing to make room for women at the table? And I think that's something that every business really needs to look at.
Well, it's not just room at the table, but being able to not make fun of women and the needs that women have in raising the families and doing the multiplicity of things that women are called to do.
That's right. And it's really honoring that work, too. That's important work. How many women who are middle-aged today are leaving their jobs to take care of an elder relative? That number is growing because there are, again, no really long-term care services and supports. It's a whole nother issue that's critical.
I want to ask you about a survey that just came out. It's published in Money Magazine today. Princeton Survey Research Associates conducted telephone interviews in early June with about 1,000 U.S. adults. And what they came to find is that millennials are saving at a higher rate than perhaps we thought they were, that 18 to 36-year-olds say they have enough savings to cover at least 3 months' worth of expenses, and that's a bit higher than, the 49% that people age 56 and up say they have to cover. But, when we see studies like this that give the impression that maybe millennials are getting the message that they need to save, it seems, though, it needs to be tempered by what are those expenses and some of the things that you've talked about. I'm wondering what you make of this study.
Well, I just learned of that study this morning, so I'm going to take a look at it more closely. It looks very suspect to me. I would like to know who were the 1,000 people that they actually interviewed. Many other studies actually show that millennials are struggling in terms of the types of jobs they have, the income they're making, moving back with parents. So there are a number of issues that I would find very suspicious about that study, and I think I'll look at it more closely myself.
As we need to say goodbye in just about a minute or so, what's the big takeaway that you'd like to leave younger women to ponder?
I know that There are so many unanswered questions about getting older. None of us know how long we're going to live, how much money we're going to need, how many resources. But think that here in Hawaii, we have our longest longevity. Most of us will live long lives. There will be expenses as we get older. And we'll get older sooner than we think. So start planning now. It truly will make a difference. But on the other hand, advocate for yourself and advocate for others for a more just society.
And know, as you learned a little later than you had wanted to, about what compounded interest might do if you put away $20 a month if you're 20 years old.
That's right. That's right. But and try to get the best job that you can, get the best education you can, but help those who really have barriers and obstacles that don't allow that to happen.
I hear you saying that women should be helping women at a greater level.
Absolutely.
Dr. Colette Brown, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Colette Brown is professor at the Myron B. Thompson College of Social Work at UH Manoa. A link to her study can be found on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Paddle Sports on Maui, providing sustainable eco-tours with a dedication to using business for environmental and social change. HawaiianPaddleSports.com.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. How often do you lie?
People just are in such a habit of lying in their day-to-day life.
And how often do you gossip?
Everybody consumes and produces gossip.
Economics of lying and gossiping. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Sunday morning at 11.
This is the conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, poets tackle a historic murder. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
Later in the program, we'll be hearing about an effort to manage crowds at the summit of Haleakala. Haleakala National Park is considered one of the smaller parks in the national system. It covers an area of 33,265 acres, elevation 10,023 feet at the summit. It contains countless hiking trails, places to explore, and some of the most threatened plants and animals of any U.S. national park. Because of its topographical, ecological, and climatic diversity, Haleakala, which means House of the Sun, was even declared an International Biosphere Reserve by UNESCO. It stands alone today, Haleakala National Park. But it started out as a part of Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, which included lands on both Maui and Hawaii Island. Eventually, the parks were separated, and that brings us to our backyard question for today. Can you tell us what year marked their separation? If you know, call us 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you know the answer, you'll get the prize.
Guten Tag, dies ist Markus Wessendorf. Sollten Sie einen Beitrag dieser Sendung noch einmal hören wollen, gehen Sie bitte auf die Website theconversation@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Award-winning poet and novelist Juliet Kono is our guest today. Many remember her first collection of poems titled Hilo Rains. It was back in 1988. Her most recent novel, Anshu, Dark Sorrow, is about a Japanese-American woman's story. It's touched by events of World War II. Juliet is a member of the Bamboo Ridge Writers Group, which published her most recent collaboration titled What We Must Remember.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is frightening for me.
Well, you know what? I love talking to writers because they have actually done some thinking. They always have. And after I read the prologue in this book, I knew I was in good hands. Thank you so much. We're here talking about a new publication by Bamboo Ridge. It's called What We Must Remember. And it's done by a Renshi group, of which Juliet Kono is a part. The group includes Christy Passion, Ann Inoshita, and Jean Yamasaki Toyama. And this Renshi form, can we just take a moment to talk about it? Juliet, it's a Japanese form of linked poetry in which last lines of one poem become the first line of the next person's poem. So even writing in this way challenges that kind of romantic notion of the single genius creator, right?
Right.
It kind of lifts up the whole idea of collaboration.
Right. Our first book of Renshi with Anne and Jean and Christy and myself, no choice but to follow.
Mm-hmm. It was so well received.
It was well received. Uh-huh. We had fun doing that. But this book, What We Must Remember, was sort of confined.
It was confined to a topic this mm-hmm. time. And mm-hmm. you chose the Massacre of Hawaii case, such a pivotal case in Hawaii's history in 1931-32. Could you give us a quick summary of that?
In September 1931, this woman, Thalia Massey, after meeting her friends and her husband at a Alawai boat club, she went walking by herself, and she alleges that on the way, she was abducted by five Hawaiian men and taken somewhere and raped. There was a trial, and it was a hung jury. The second part is that Joseph Kahawai was later abducted by her husband.
That's Thalia Massey's husband.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Mother and two other men.
And he was murdered in Manoa and later taken to Halona blowhole to be,
where they were caught red-handed by police.
Right. Of course, then there was another trial. And soon after the trial, they were found guilty and sentenced to 10 years. But then right after that, their sentence was commuted. They spent 1 hour in a governor's office and released.
This was giant news at the time, but actually not very widely discussed in general society after that because of the racial tension in this in our community, actually.
Right. World War II came along and, racism, nobody wanted to talk about it. So there was a silence about this case for a long time.
And true tragedy, Thalia Massey eventually committed suicide. Mm-hmm. This story continues to reverberate. And when you approach this topic, you four poets took it from so many different angles.
Yes. I guess we would have done it differently if we were to do it today. Maybe we would take a certain character and follow him or her all the way through in poetic form. But we were all over the place. We didn't know what was going to turn out it was very trying in a sense because and we gave up.
Why? You hit a wall somehow? Why? How? Why? What was
it? It was too emotional for us, I think. And it felt like it was just cut into pieces, and we weren't telling a story. There were holes in the story that we couldn't.
You had to deal with evidence, facts,
the people involved, and how were we going to put all this together?
As poets,
yeah. So we said, okay, we'll just quit.
Let's have a beer.
Yeah.
Okay, poets.
Yeah, but then the temper of the times. Now.
Sent you back to your pens and paper.
Yeah, and sort of said, well, maybe we have something here. Maybe there are issues we could discuss that would, you know, sort of break it open in a sense also.
Yeah. So you went back at it. How did it finally crack open?
Later, we said, I'm done. It was just like, I couldn't go anymore. And Jean felt that way, Christy felt that way, Anne felt that way, that we just couldn't write anymore about this. Oh. And we felt it was incomplete somehow. But when we read it now, we feel that it's has gone through what we had hoped to achieve in the first place. But that was how.
Which is what? What did you? Because the story, the timeline, it's there.
Yeah.
And in fact, John Rosa did a fabulous job for you there.
That's right. And I think when you tie it all together, it seems like a whole piece, which is just wonderful.
It's kind of amazing. Because you've taken so many different points of view here.
Right, right.
Kaha Hawaii's mother.
Mother, right.
I mean, just these different points of view are presented poetically. And then at the very end, all of you have commented again.
Yes, yes.
That's really care. That's care.
But I think the comments help the reader to put it all together, too, and to see what we had done or what emotional, you know, hurdles we went through and what we felt about all this thing, even what was happening in Ferguson and with the Didi case. And, you know, we could talk about those issues.
Well, this is a fabulous book. It's wonderful to have it. I just want to thank the four of you for the work that's been done. You've been on it since 2011. Thank
yes.
you so much
thank
for the
you.
Work and the poetry.
No, thank you for inviting me here. It's been interesting.
Julia. Got to get you out more.
Yes.
Poet Juliet Kono, Bamboo Ridge Press, will hold a book fair and book signing for What We Must Remember at Barnes & Noble, Ala Moana Center, this Saturday. That's June 24th from 2 to 3 p.m. Juliet will be there. And there'll also be a reading and reception at Opuni Place there in Ward Warehouse at the Eva End, July 9th, 2:30. Find out more at the Bamboo Ridge website or find links on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
A letter to the feds assuring them of Hawaii's commitment to rail may bring optimism, but is there really a deal to be brokered when lawmakers say they'll meet in a special session sometime this summer? New Civil Beat Politics and Opinion Editor Chad Blair has the reality check. Hi there, and congratulations on your new
Thanks
position.
Thanks for the plug, Beth, and I sure appreciate that, and it's a great honor to continue working here at Civil Beat to have a job in journalism, right?
You bet. Now, yesterday we heard news of the special session.
Right.
Obviously, there are no dates yet, or we'd be talking about it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the last time that you and I were talking about this, Chad, and we said the word special session, there was also the caveat that this had to come with a really high probability of a deal to be brokered at the legislature. Is there any sense of that as you talk to lawmakers?
Well, it was the governor himself who said, look, I'm not going to call a special session unless the House and Senate actually have a compromise deal to fund the rail system. The announcement yesterday came from the House, from the Speaker, Scott Psyche. Ron Kochi, the Senate president, wasn't there. He was on Kauai. But both he and Psyche did send this letter to the FDA saying, look, we're working on this. We can assure you. But as to whether there is a deal, I don't think Speaker Psyche, would have announced that there would be a special session without some sort of agreement. Remember how embarrassing it was, really the epic failure, just 6-7 weeks ago when the House and Senate couldn't come up with a deal, even though they had been debating the rail tax all session long. So
right. The point being that they wouldn't set them up, yeah. themselves up for failure again.
No, but having said that, we did see what happened. It took 3.5 months, and they couldn't even get there, although it looked like they had a compromise deal there in the last couple of days. But it fell through. And in essence, the House had pushed for using more of the hotel tax to pay for the rail project versus the Senate version, which relied on extending the general excise tax. And that was pretty much where their standoff was.
Any sense of how lawmakers are now in better talking terms with the mayor, or whether this is being done separately?
Those discussions, we were told, have been going on behind the scenes. The mayor himself, Caldwell, expressed optimism, said he was pleased yesterday. There is still some tension. You could just kind of feel it. Nathan Eagle, in his report, he was actually there at the press conference with the speaker yesterday. Still some concern about whether they're getting the accurate numbers from Hart, from the city, on just how much this thing is going to cost. It wasn't all that long ago. It was $5.2 billion. Before that, I think it was $3 billion. And then now the figure is $10 billion. We're not even talking about operations and maintenance down the road. But there's still, I think, a little gray area. The mayor, however, says they believe that the most current financial estimates are accurate and have been provided. So we'll see. There's just this general distrust, I think, particularly between the House and the Caldwell administration. But there is sense that they are talking about this, that they wouldn't come to the table, even though they're not quite showing what the plan is going to be.
Which means that you and I will no doubt be talking about it very soon once we get wind of some of that plan. Thanks very much, Chad. And again, congratulations on your new position.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org, today featuring new politics and opinion editor Chad Blair. Travel sites often tell visitors coming to Maui to see the summit of Haleakala at sunrise. That time frame has always been popular, but in the last year, cars bringing sunrise visitors grew by 21%. The park is feeling the impact of both the vehicles and the people in them. A parking lot offering only 150 spaces often holds as many as 380 cars. Starting tomorrow, the park is asking for public input. We called Lynette King, the Environmental Compliance Coordinator at Haleakala National Park, to find out what it was about last year that brought such a jump in sunrise activity.
You see sunrise in every guidebook, in a lot of online blogs that people are following. And sunrise, the pre-dawn hours, have been steadily our busiest time of day. So I really think it's because the word is out there and people are paying attention to what others are doing. And it's a great photo to take for social media and has just become a really popular event.
You mentioned social media. Because that's such an instantaneous way of communicating, how then do you see this moving forward in a time where, people are going to continue to share information that many of us have known and many visitors who have come to Hawaii have known for decades?
That is a tough question with social media. Everything happens so fast. But overall, we're just trying to make the experience better because we started hearing a lot of comments about crowding and we started seeing people walking off trail, which could cause resource damage. So if we can improve the experience, hopefully that will be a positive thing for the people who do come up to Haleakala Sunrise. So over time, we're hoping to improve the system so that the people who are up there can have a really pleasant experience. And instead of seeing a photo with 500 people in the background, maybe it's a more serene moment for them.
When you talk also about social media's ability to talk to a great number of people at the same time, you're also potentially talking about being able to deputize them to give out some of the information that you would like people to know about it, like not going off trail, like making sure that they make their reservation. In some ways, couldn't that also work to your favor?
That would be great. We'll take any help we could get to get the word out, definitely.
What happens when people do go off trail?
There's potential for resource damage because we do have endangered species habitat up there. We also have vegetation that's very fragile. It's a high elevation environment. So just to protect those things, it's important for visitors to stay on trail. So we have throughout the whole park a stay on trail message.
We also see people going
off trail, which could result in sprained ankles or other injuries. It's usually minor injuries. And also people will go off trail to try to get away from the crowd. So the more crowding there is, the more off trail situations that we're incurring. And then people sometimes end up using the restroom out there, and we end up finding human waste or just trash, wrappers, and things like that. So overall, it's not creating a very pristine environment, which it should be at the top.
Which kind of sounds like we have really created this situation for ourselves, those people who have come to visit and not paid attention. There seems to be a real thrill for a lot of folks in going off trail and using that very liberally, not just with Haleakala, but with many other places too, that sense of the forbidden trail, the forbidden place of, you know, whether it's going up the stairs or going other places where you're not supposed to go, there seems to be this real attraction. Is there any way that you can see to mitigate that in ways that might be an example to those who might consider doing that just for the thrill of it? Would there be greater fines? Would there be making an example of someone, 86ing them from national parks, or anything that might really say, hey, we're serious about this?
I don't have any specific solutions for that, although we are in a public comment period. So if someone wanted to suggest a way to reduce our off-trail wanderings, that's an option. But overall, I think if we reduce the number of people at sunrise and really increase the experience that they're having at that time, that the desire to go off-trail will be less. So overall, the problem started when the parking lots were exceeding capacity for years and years. But the crowding has become worse in both magnitude and frequency. So, for example, our highest car count was July 26, 2016, and we had 384 cars.
Wow.
We only have 150 spaces. So 384 cars and 150 spaces just does not work. So I think by reducing the number of cars up there, which reduces the number of people up there, hopefully the desire to go off trail will be less, and overall just the experience will be more meaningful for those up there, where they can really see the beauty of the summit or experience the sacredness of this place and then kind of find some solitude in the outdoors, which is why most people come to a national park. And if there's cultural practitioners in the area, I think that that would be a more meaningful experience for them too. When you don't have 384 cars, maybe you only have 150.
I'm really struck by those numbers. When you think about where are these people going to be parking if there are only 150 spots, it sounds like you've just looked at this, you know, massive parking lot, literally where no one can get out, and they're hemmed in at all corners.
Right, right. And so when people are having to rush up, then they're also speeding through the park, which is another concern because that's a very windy road. Crater Road is a two-lane historic road. It's the only access to the summit of Haleakala. So we have four main viewpoints for sunrise, but before the pilot program with the reservation, people were rushing up and driving faster and not paying attention, and that is not a safe situation. And it's dark, of course, so you're adding an unfamiliar environment and darkness for people who are on vacation and up really early and maybe on the wrong time zone. So it just wasn't the safest situation either. It was just time to come up with a solution, so that's why we're having this process right now.
And just to be really clear about that, people could make a reservation online for up to 60 days in advance, but there is a fee attached to that, yes?
Correct. It's only $1.50 for the sunrise reservation. You also pay the park entrance fee, but if you're coming in outside of the hours between 3 and 7 a.m., then you do not need the reservation. And the reservation's done, made through recreation.gov.
If you have a pass that allows you to go to any national park, because I think when you're, over age 65, that becomes an option?
Correct. We still accept that pass, but then if you're coming between 3 and 7 a.m., you would need a reservation also because it's done through a different system.
So it doesn't get you off of that one. It just gets you in for free, but you still have to make the reservation, and I take it still pay the $1.50 to make it.
Correct.
Well, we'll see what happens. We've got a month for people to be able to make their comments, and then we'll check back with you and see what kind of comments you collected and where this proposed system goes.
Yeah, excellent. We're looking for any solutions that would reduce the problems with crowding, including the visitor and staff safety, natural and cultural resource damages, and then also how to fix the diminished experience for visitors and cultural practitioners at the summit during sunrise.
Well, we wish you all the best. We'd like to see it stay pristine and enjoyable for everyone. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Lynette King is the Environmental Compliance Coordinator at Haleakala National Park. Her work includes the Sunrise Visitation Environmental Assessment, the Kipihulu Comprehensive Plan Environmental Assessment, Scientific Research Permit Reviews, and other park compliance projects. Now, you can add your input to the public comment on Sunrise Visitation Management. The link is on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
I mean, I'm 300 pounds. I play football and like roll around and drink beer. So I was a little bit hesitant when they came to me and said, hey, we want to send you away for a week to a all-intensive yoga retreat.
Join us next time for stories from the Moth's open mic Story Slam events around the country. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at 2 p.m., right after This American Life.
Aloha, I'm Abe Legrimas, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
We were just talking about Haleakala National Park a moment ago. And so for today's backyard quiz, we looked back at its history. Now, covering an area of 33,265 acres and rising to an elevation of 10,023 feet at its summit, Haleakala is still considered one of the smaller parks in the national system. That said, it contains plenty of space to explore, as well as some of the most threatened plants and animals found in any U.S. national park. Because of its great diversity, Haleakala, which means House of the Sun in Hawaiian, was even designated as an International Biosphere Reserve by UNESCO. Though it stands alone today, once it was part of Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, that included land on both Maui and Hawaii Island. Eventually, the parks were split, and an entirely new national park was formed on Maui. Today, we asked you for the year it happened. It wasn't that long after statehood that Haleakala became its own park in 1961.
We did have a winner on that, Beth Ann, Tom Koenig of Mililani. And that's today's quiz. If you've got one you'd like to send in, please do it. Send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
Rivers is the director and founder of the Maui Film Festival. He credits his daily time in the ocean for inspiration and the best ideas. The Rivers Ohana moved to Maui in 1979. That's wife Stella and three kids under 2 years old in cloth diapers. Talk about brave. They had two tents. Oh, and $3,000 to fuel their dreams. The good old days. Today, they've got a solar-powered home on Maui's North Shore and work that
sets them apart on the film festival circuit. It's certainly a Maui thing, right, Barry?
It's a Maui thing. How are you doing?
Great. How's the day on Maui?
Pretty nice. We're one day away from firing up the festival, so we're all psyched. The weather's good. We're feeling good about everything right now.
Oh, man. Okay, well, your festival is known as a film festival of hope and positivity.
Yeah, we can use a little of that right now, don't you think?
I think we could. You know, just a quick overview, Barry. It's 5 days of films and food. You've mixed in so many other festivals and events that go along with it. And the whole thing starts tomorrow.
That's right. Yeah, it's we have three tastes, which feature the culinary artists throughout the Wailea Resort. We have a special VIP party at Spago as well. And then we've got 5 days of films, both at the Celestial Cinema, which is our crown jewel venue in Wailea, as well as
the Sand
Cinema, which is a complimentary venue on the beach below the Four Seasons, and also screenings at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center, which lean very sort of open, what's the word, progressively, I guess, this year. I've been internally calling it Woo-Woo Fest. There's a lot of good stuff down there for people that are into sort of evolving their consciousness and doing the right thing.
Interesting. You've kind of concentrated them there. You know, I was kind of thinking maybe we should take it by the day.
Meaning sure.
Today starts with Beatrice at Dinner.
Yeah, which is one of the most highly acclaimed films of the year. It stars mm-hmm. Salma Hayek, John Lithgow, and Connie Britton, who are actually honoring as well this year at the festival. She's receiving our Navigator Award for the way she's managed to sort of cross over from TV to film and back again and back again and back again. So that's tomorrow night as the 8 o'clock film. Every night at the Celestial Cinema is a double feature. The second film is a wonderful little film from Canada called Grand Unified Theory about an astrophysicist's last lecture to his students on the 40th anniversary of his career. He's leaving, and it's intercut. The whole film is intercut between these Hubble telescope photographs and him describing what's going on in the universe and his sort of very much out of control family life. It's very funny, very smart.
Is Scarlett Johansson really in it?
No. What I said if this film starred Scarlett Johansson, Steve Carell, Olivia Wilde, and Owen Wilson, you'd be halfway to Wailea by now because the actors are. There's not one name anyone will know in the United States, but they're all accomplished actors in Canada, and they play their roles just that well. That's what I was intending to say.
Ah, marvelous. Okay. Well, that sounds like quite an entree to the festival. That's Wednesday night. Thursday, you're on to. I love the surf film you've chosen, Big Wave Project.
It's one of the best ever. I mean, the fellow worked on this for 5 years. He's someone whose name is Tim Bonnington, and we honored him with the festival's Beacon Award a number of years ago, which we've given to a few people, including Laird Hamilton, Dave Colombo, you know, people that sort of live their lives looking for adventure and outside of fear and inside of courage is how we like to describe the award. So Tim's film, The Big Wave Project, is opening the night at 8 o'clock. It's preceded by a tribute to Frida Pinto, who people probably know best from her role in Slumdog Millionaire. And it's followed at 10 o'clock by a film called Charge. We're actually going to have the fellow here whose life story it's based on. His name is Eduardo Garcia, and he's someone who accidentally touched a bear in the woods who he thought was dead but wanted to make sure it wasn't alive and might need some help. And when he touched it, because the bear was laying on top of a transmission box in the middle of nowhere, he got electrocuted. I'm calling this film the most inspiring film that we've shown here in 18 years. Another one. And if people can do nothing other than just look at the trailer, this guy's life is being lived in such an exemplary way, given what happened to him, that no one out there should ever feel they've had a bad day until they see what this guy had to put up with.
Well, of all the films you've shown, if this is the most inspirational, it's probably got to be seen. Yep, pretty wild. You know, I'll never forget a film that I saw. It was at maybe a Celestial Cinema event many years ago, and it involved a Canadian sort of explorer of space and connectivity, but a Japanese-Canadian guy.
Suzuki.
Exactly.
Is it David Suzuki?
David Suzuki.
Oh, yeah, he's wonderful.
I mean, people run into characters and films, directors and producers at this film festival. Then they can follow their work, and you end up following a train of thought.
Yeah, it's true. Really, I like to kiddingly say we open a lot of coconuts over here, but we really do. There's some great topics being explored. Many are new to people. And, you know, honestly, we work so hard to put this together every year that I feel no need, at the slightest degree even, to sort of rehash what's going on in the world, more so the last couple of years. You know, there's enough 24/7 news out there and real facts and fake facts, and I'm just sort of sick of it all. What I'm interested in is building a future worth living in for my granddaughter, frankly, or our granddaughter, and that's the kind of stuff I'm especially focused on the last couple of years. And this year, frankly, hits it out of the park. It's a great year in that regard.
You've really chosen some very pointed films, including one that's coming up on the Friday, Poisoning Paradise, specifically relating to us here in Hawaii, and what, produced, co-directed by Pierce Brosnan.
He's the executive producer. His wife, Keely Brosnan, and her longtime friend co-directed the film. Mm-hmm. Their friend's name is Terry Tico. They all live in Kauai. Pierce is actually being honored this year as well for his work as a film artist. He was honored, I want to say, 6 or 7 years ago for his work as an environmentalist. So he's very much continued to walk the walk and not just talk the talk of how much he cares about the planet and doing the right thing and sharing the right and important information. So he'll be honored prior to the screening of Kuleana, and Kuleana is the film that precedes Poisoning Paradise as well. Poisoning Paradise, to be clear, is a film that's about the spraying issue on Kauai and the GMO issue on Kauai, and I just think it's a topic that's extremely important. I mean, even to the point where the legislature didn't pass a law and had a chance to do so to inform schools and others living in proximity to the fields that were being sprayed, that they were going to be sprayed the following day or in 3 days or whatever. So that didn't even get through the legislature. So I just think people need to wake up a little bit and realize that this stuff's no joke. And they really need to act as if it's real, because it is real, and it's not healthy for people of any age, especially for younger people. So that's actually the 10 o'clock film. At 8 o'clock, between the 10 o'clock Poisoning Paradise and the Pierce Brosnan tribute at 8, there's a film called Kuleana, which you may have heard of already. It's from a director on Maui, a Maui-born and bred director whose name is Brian Cohn. And his film is produced by Stephen Schaefer, who's not a Maui-born person, but mm-hmm. certainly has lived here a long time, is very Hawaiian-hearted.
Really excited about that one, too.
They've done a film set in 1971 on Maui in the era of the Kohalavi bombing and the sort of renaissance of Hawaiian mm-hmm. music and language and dance. And it's a really interesting story, very well done. It stars
a number of people. I hope so. You know, Hawaii topics, you've got to tread lightly and do it right in these islands. Yep. We've just got a minute left here.
Okay.
So I really wanted to point out that you've got films about some of the challenges we face, as well as films about healing and films about ways to go. I'm really excited about the shorts you've got coming up as well.
Thank you.
Often that's a way to see some up-and-coming lights. Are those the ones that are going to be at the MAC?
There are going to be some of those showing before features at the MAC, and there's about a 14 or 15 film showcase that's free on the beach at the Toes in the Sand Cinema. I also want to just really quickly thank Hawaiian Airlines, who is our lead sponsor again this year for, I don't know, third or fourth year in a row. We love having them around. And, yeah, it's all at the website. The bottom line is there's much more we didn't get to talk about at MauiFilmFestival.com. We also have a Twitter and a Instagram presence. So, yeah, if you're interested in the kind of things that we're up to, feel free to check us out.
The Maui Film Festival is a different kind of thing, Barry. Thanks to you and the people who really put it together. Mahalo to the whole festival, Ohana. It takes a legion of volunteers. The Maui Film Festival runs June 21st to 25th. Full schedule, each day of screenings or related events. Check it out at MauiFilmFestival.com. And we thank you, Barry.
So much. Always love talking to you. Take
all
care.
Right. Check it all out and find links on the Conversation Facebook page. It's a moment to take a look at things going on under the radar with my colleague here, host of Morning Edition,
yes,
Derek Malama. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Noe.
What's up?
Okay, well, tomorrow you can hear a Hoku Award winner sing for free.
Hmm.
It's taking place at Kona Nui Nights. And that happens the third Wednesday of every month in the Ward Village Courtyard, highlighting Hawaiian music and hula. Josh Tatofi will perform. Yeah.
Interesting. Are you familiar with his work?
Actually, yes. He has an album called Puakiele, and he won this year's Nahoku Hanohano Award for Top Male Vocalist. And this event starts at 6 p.m. Doors open at 5:45. There's limited seating. Free parking is available in the TJ Maxx parking garage or in the Ward Center parking garage.
Ooh, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And you usually do a little tour around the island?
Yes, we'll go to the Big Island. The Kailua Kona Public Library is hosting a program tomorrow for ages 8 to 11 on protecting Hawaiian monk seals. Susanna Welch is with the Marine Wildlife Program, and she'll talk to Keiki about protecting the seals and the use of barbless circle hooks in recreational fishing. And kids will create their own barbless hooks and receive Keiki Angler fishing kits.
That sounds great.
Yeah, this program is tomorrow at the Kailua Kona Public Library from 3 to 4. It's limited to the first 20 children and their adult caregivers. So you do need to make reservations and call the phone number that's on our website for this.
Boy, that sounds like fun. Mm-hmm. Books and a little hands-on.
Yeah. Okay. Now we'll go to also on the Big Island. Hawaii Volcanoes National Park is hosting a free concert tomorrow. The Quartet of Komakakino. They're from Kealkaha. Have you heard of them?
I haven't. Have you heard them yet?
Yeah, I played them on Kanikapila Sunday.
Really? Do they have that old Hawaiian sound? It sounds like they might.
Right, right. They're falsetto singers, and they also have a steel guitar player. They're very young, but they sound like they've been playing for years, and they've recorded two albums so far. And this concert with Komakakino is tomorrow night at 6:30 in the Kilauea Visitor Center Auditorium at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. It is free with park admission.
Oh, that sounds great. Mm-hmm. A couple of free events you've come up with for us here. In fact, all of them were. Thanks so much, Derek.
Yes, you're welcome.
All right. Well, it's a terrific chance to check in with some of the things going on around town under the radar with our friend here, Derek Malama.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000, wishing all students, parents, teachers, and administrators an enjoyable summer, providing opportunities for student summer reading with Achieve Hawaii Home Access. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
And with that, we're going to say goodbye as we're coming up to the top of the hour. But don't worry, Noe and I will be back tomorrow. Thanks so much for paying attention to us today and tuning in. We're glad to know that you're there. Now, up tomorrow, Neil Milner will bring us some new research on Asian discrimination in two timeframes and two states.
Mm. Plus, the art collective Paradise Cove. They've been staging some of the most thought-provoking projects in town. Drew Broderick will be in to chat about their work. And the Smithsonian Museum's planning a show of Native Hawaiian and Pacific issues and work. It's a new concept to bring living museums to Honolulu. More on that tomorrow.
You can comment about anything you hear on the program on our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR.
I'm Noe Tanigawa.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet up tomorrow for more of The Conversation.